Good evening. Let me begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of this land and pay my respects to the elders of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, past, present and emerging. My name is Jonathan Pryke. I am director of the Pacific Islands program here at the Lowy Institute. And in 2019, it's really no better time to be talking about the Pacific Islands. In the past week, we've had a major diplomatic defection. We've had Frank Bainimarama's first official visit to Australia. And we've had discussions of potential Papua New Guinea bailouts. Over the last 2 years, the Pacific Islands region has vaulted from the fringes back to the centre of Australian foreign policy thinking. Job security as a Pacific analyst here at the Lowy Institute has never looked better. With the spectre of China and strategic competition now looming large, governments are scrambling to re-engage. So far, we've had a step up, a reset, a pivot, an uplift and an elevation. We're quickly running out of good metaphors. Inserted into the middle of this context is the Lowy Institute's Pacific Aid Map, launched in August 2018 for the primary purpose of helping make aid in the Pacific more effective. The map has also been a very useful tool for talking about some of the new geopolitical dynamics that have captured the public's attention. Tonight, we have the pleasure of releasing the first annual update to the map and showcasing some new analysis on debt sustainability in the Pacific that draws on the map's underlying data. To do that, I will be joined by my Lowy colleagues, Alex Dionne, who has led the aid map from its inception, Roland Raja, who runs our international economy program and is lead author on our forthcoming paper looking at debt dynamics in the Pacific, and Natasha Kassam, the head of our polling work at the Institute and a former Australian diplomat who has spent quite a bit of time in Solomon Islands. We've got a few moving pieces here tonight. I'm going to start off with a bit of an introduction of why we created the aid map. Alex is going to give you a demonstration of all of the map's features, including some new ones. I'll highlight a few of the key findings, some new, some the same. Roland will then run us through a closer look at debt dynamics in the Pacific. And finally, Natasha will run a conversation with us, including taking your questions from the floor. So we're putting a lot of faith in three think tankers not falling in love with the sound of their own voices. But I'm forever an optimist. So please bear with us, and hopefully we'll get to plenty of discussion with you all. So let's start this evening where it will likely finish, talking about China, because China is where this project began. In 2015, the Lowy Institute launched the Chinese Aid in the Pacific Interactive Map. The map, the first of its kind in the Pacific, highlighted comprehensively the breadth and significance of China's aid efforts in the Pacific this century. The map garnered a lot of attention, a lot of clicks, and generated a lot of policy discussions. These are all hallmarks of a very successful Lowy Institute research product. But China isn't the only donor to the region. It's also not the most significant. In any given year, more than $2 billion in aid, equal to around 7% of the total GDP of the Pacific, is invested in the region by more than 60 donors. And make no mistake, foreign aid is crucially important for the Pacific, a region facing unique and acute development challenges. With a cumulative population of under 13 million people, most of which reside in Australia's former colony, Papua New Guinea, these 14 sovereign nations span over 15% of the world's surface. The dual tyrannies of small size and remoteness make conventional economic growth approaches in most of these countries very difficult, if not impossible. Compounded by some of the highest population growth rates in the world and the very real and imminent threat of climate change, the Pacific is one of the most fragile regions in the world and is the most aid dependent. The aid industry, though, is a messy one and at times opaque. Public information at the project level for all donors is often sparse, lacks detail, and is difficult to access. A lack of transparency can hamper the effectiveness of aid in a number of ways. It poses difficulties in the coordination of aid efforts by donors. You need to have a comprehensive view of the aid landscape to know where you can make the most difference. And donors are not that often the best communicators. A lack of aid transparency increases the challenges for countries in the Pacific to align aid with their own investment priorities. Take, for example, Kiribati. Their entire budget team is 6 people. They have to deal with 47 separate donors on top of managing the country's finances. A lack of transparency also stymies efforts of donors to learn from one another and from the past. And finally, a lack of transparency reduces accountability of aid, both for the sending and receiving parties. Greater accountability for aid can only help improve the value for money we get out of these investments. So considering all these benefits of aid transparency and the success of our original Chinese aid map, a question we were routinely asked since 2015 is, if you can do this for China, why not do it for everyone? Well, this is precisely what we set out to do with the Pacific Aid Map. Over the last 2.5 years, Alex and I have worked to put together the most comprehensive database of aid information ever assembled for a particular part of the world. Our database collects data at the transaction level of 20,000 projects from 62 donors from 2011 through to today. We have collected close to 40 million unique data points, and we've then worked to take this raw data and put it into a digital format that is digestible, accessible, attractive, and freely available. What we ended up with is the Lowy Institute Pacific Aid Map. I'll now hand you over to my colleague Alex, the brains behind the aid map, to tell you how we did it and to run you through the final product. Over to you, Alex.
Good evening, everyone.
I'm going just to sit here.
Well, so before I jump to show you the details and the sophistication of the Pacific Aid Map, I thought that maybe it'd be better like if I could explain a little bit how we built the map. The first step for us was to actually collect project information from what we call the traditional donors. So that would be Australia, New Zealand, France, Belgium, even the World Bank. And so to get this information, we went on the OECD, which has a data set already pretty consistent. And then we filled up the gaps with another data set that is that has been created by the United Nations. However, when we mixed both of these datasets, we still had gaps, so we had to engage directly with the donors themselves. Sorry. So that was for the traditional donors. For the non-traditional donors, such as China, Russia, the UAE, it was actually a bit more complicated because, well, as you can imagine, like China really didn't answer our emails. Russia didn't answer our phone calls.
Israel got back to you in Hebrew.
Exactly. I sent an email to Israel and I had to write it in Hebrew thanks to Google Translate, but I didn't really understand the answer. So the thing is that, we because of this complication, we had to adopt a more hands-on approach. We had to go through like every budget document from the Pacific Island countries, through every press release, every news report, to try to find information on each particular project and to be able to triangulate it just to make sure that this information was actually accurate, that the project was happening on the ground. And once we had this entire data set of traditional and non-traditional donors, then what we tried to do is like we tried to validate it with the Pacific Island countries themselves. The issue, though, it was that, as you can imagine, like the Pacific Island countries don't always have reporting mechanisms that are sophisticated enough to be able to validate the granularity of all the information that we had. But at the end, we came up with like a pretty consistent data set. And throughout this entire process, actually, we're pretty confident that we've built the most comprehensive and detailed source of information on aid projects in the Pacific that has ever been created. So anyway, we after decided to put everything on a map, and that's what it looks like. So let's have a look. So here you go. This is the you can see. So good. This is the landing page of the Pacific Aid Map. So it provides high-level information at a regional level. So you land on the year 2017, which is the year for which we have the most up-to-date information. However, you can still filter the year from 2011 onwards. The outer ring that we actually called the donor ring ranks the donor by order or sheer magnitude. So here you see that Australia was the first donor in 2017, then New Zealand, followed by Japan, China. Every time you click on a donor, the summary information on the left automatically updates. And the inner circle, are like the Pacific Island countries. So same thing, when you hover over one of the countries, the summary information on the left updates, so it gives like who are the top donors of these countries, demographic information, and so on. We also decided to implement a full range of filters. Like the first filter is by donors. So we have 62 different donors. So through this filter, you can choose if you want to focus on Australia, on New Zealand, or whoever. Then you can look at different Pacific Island countries that we have. So we have 14 Pacific Island countries. You can look at the sector. So we have the 12th sector of the OECD. And then you can look also like what type of flow are you interested in. So like in aid, when a country gives aid to another country, you can give aid through the form of grants and through the form of loans. But sometimes there are actually flows that don't get into this definition, that they're not aid, they are like investments or non-concessional funding or security training, for instance. So this is actually a new feature of this year. Another filter that we have is on the status, like if you're looking for a project that is being implemented or completed. So all these filters allow you basically to create your own Pacific aid map. When you click on a particular country, let's say Vanuatu, we're going to look for a project, the Luganville project. So when you look up, when you look for a particular country, then you're being drawn down to like the country level, and so it becomes to illustrate the sheer magnitude of the data underpinning the map. Remember that we have 20,000 projects. So when you click on a particular project, you have the information on the left that updates. So it gives you like the name of the project, where the project is being implemented, who is the donor, who's the implementing partner. Like, we also realize that most of the implementing partner don't actually have the technical capabilities to be able to implement all the projects, so they have to go through like different partners.
Like NGOs, development contractors, this is Shanghai Construction Group. You may all remember this, made a lot of headlines, the Vanuatu Wharf project back last year.
Mm-hmm. So the issue here is that, you know, as Jonathan mentioned, we have like 20,000 projects, and on this 20,000 project, 90% of the project didn't actually have geo-coordinates. So it means that Jono and I had to actually spend days and nights and even weekends to basically try to find the perfect location for all these projects.
Had I known that when I signed us up to do the Pacific Aid Map, I never, never, never would have committed to it.
Well, the good thing though is that now, like, we have actually a pretty good understanding of the geography of the Pacific.
Yeah, we're still waiting for that trivia round to come up in the pub trivia, but we're on it.
We're on it. So the thing though is that there are still some projects that you can't put on the map. How do you put budget support, for instance? How do you put scholarships? Because we couldn't put them on the map, we decided to actually broaden the scope of like our ambition for this specific aid map, and we decided to implement new tools. One of these tools is the dashboard. So the dashboard allows you to basically compare one donor with another, or one Pacific Island country with another. So in Australia, a lot of people have actually been comparing Australia with China. So if you compare Australia with China here, it takes a bit of time to load because, yeah, we just had like 40 million different entry points. So if you compare Australia with China, then you'll see that Australia has many more projects in 2017 in the Pacific than China. But like China still spends $170 million in the Pacific. It means that basically China has spent a lot of money on a few projects, but they're like massive. They're like these big infrastructure projects that you see everywhere in the Pacific. The more you go down, the more you have high-level information on the project that are being implemented. You see how much money has been committed in the region by this donor, how much money has been spent. And you also have a sectorial repartition, which actually gives you an idea of like the specialization of each of the donors. So here, for instance, you see that Australia has given 23% of its aid in 2017 in the education sector. Australia focuses a lot on governance, like trying to make the institution of the Pacific much stronger. However, China, you see that China spends a lot more on transport. Another tool is the graphing tool, which allows you to basically create trend analysis throughout the Pacific. So, for instance, this week, the Solomon Islands decided to switch its diplomatic recognition from Taiwan to China. And there are a lot of speculation on how much money did China put on the table for this to happen. So one way of looking at it is to actually try to understand how much money Taiwan was giving to the Solomon Islands. And thanks to this tool, you can actually, for the first time, clearly see how much money was being given.
So this is a new feature of this year.
Yeah, this is a new feature. And obviously, like, there are many more graphs you can do. I really recommend you to have a look at the Pacific Aid Map at home and do your own little graphs.
There's thousands and thousands of different combinations you can put together in this graphing tool.
Yeah. Another page we have is the database. So the database is basically a depository of the 20,000 projects that we have. You can look for a project by name, by date of implementation, by filter, by even implementing partners. So we have information on 1,500 implementing partners. Here, Jono looked for the Luganville project that we just looked on the map, and it gives you basically more detailed information on this project. So what's the description, the transaction history, And whenever we could, we tried to find websites that were basically giving you more information on this project. You can obviously...
Because it's a China project, there's no website.
Yeah. Well, it's linked to some articles. And you can obviously download the entire data set. It's pretty big, though. Like, it will take some time, and you need a good connection. And then we have the About page. The About page is basically... On this page, we basically explain how we build the Pacific 8 map. You can even, like, download the 200-page methodology that nobody ever read about us.
I met someone in New Zealand who has read it, Alex.
Well, my gosh.
I felt very sad for her.
And so we explain all of this. We also, from this page, you can also download a template of the data set that we have, because we know that the Pacific 8 map has actually some gaps. Like, we've collected information on 20,000 projects, but there are still many projects that we might have missed. So we hope that the users can actually help us feed the Pacific 8 map by giving us information on the project that we missed. So this is the map. We are committed to update it for the next 3 years, and if there is more appetite, well, we might be updated, immediately. So I hope you enjoyed it. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Alex. So, as you can all see, the aid map is an exceptionally rich source of data. Since we launched the map last year in Samoa alongside foreign ministers from across the Pacific, the map has been viewed close to 100,000 times. We have had feedback from donors, consultants, NGOs, media, academics, that this is making a positive contribution. We are running workshops with recipient countries' relevant ministries to help them draw the most out of the map. We are confident that the map is already well on the way of fulfilling its primary purpose to make aid in the Pacific better. But what's new in the 2019 version of the map? Alex has run you through some of the changed functional features. But the most significant change is the underlying data itself. We now have a comprehensive information from all donors for another full year, taking us up to the end of 2017. Now, there is a lag, an overhang here. We are trying to get things up to real time, but many donors, including Australia, it takes a long time for them to properly audit their data before they're happy to have it out in the public domain. They can and should do better, but 18 months is what we have to deal with. So overall, in 2017, many of the trends remain the same. Australia and New Zealand are still the dominant players in the Pacific, accounting for 54% of all aid over the period of the data set. Aid has also been quite steady in nominal terms between 2011 and 2017. After a drop last year to under $2 billion, aid has rebounded and now continues to hover at around $2.3 billion. The return to trend has largely been driven by favourable exchange rate movements, increases from the ADB, EU and World Bank, and a near 80% increase from the United States after, in 2016, funds were withheld from two countries, Federated States of Micronesia and Marshall Islands, by Congress for no fault of their own. It was just part of the budgetary process in Congress running its course. However, while the nominal amount has remained the same, its overall value is decreasing, both as a result of inflation and as a share of overall regional GDP as the Pacific continues to slowly grow. Other trends we've noticed in 2017 include the World Bank and ADB continuing to grow in importance, and China's aid disbursements remaining flat. There are a lot of other new insights we're eager to tease out over the next few months, but for this evening, we're going to focus in on dynamics of debt, because this has been a very topical issue over the last few years. Before I hand over to Roland, I'd like to talk about these dynamics through two graphs. So just bear with me here for a moment. So this first graph shows how total official flows, and total official flows are largely aid, but also non-aid types of flows, so non-concessional loans that Alex mentioned before, and other types of investments such as defense support, federal police support, and a few other things. This shows how these flows have changed over the time of our aid map from 2011 to 2017. We use this chart to illustrate the change in relevance of importance of donors over this period. Keep a particular focus on Australia, China, and the ADB. So a few things stand out here. The first is that no one comes within a stone's throw of Australia, even as aid flows accumulate. The second is that formal investment in the region is largely dominated by six actors in the billion-dollar club. These actors are Australia, New Zealand, China, the ADB, US, and Japan, and together they make up more than 80% of investment in the region over this period. Finally, the ADB and China in particular have emerged as more significant partners to the Pacific over this period, which brings us to our second chart. The second chart breaks down donor activity into loans and grants. Keep an eye on the five donors that are highlighted who are the loan-giving donors in the Pacific. So let's take a look. As this graph moves, we can see that over time, loans have become a larger contributor to the overall financial picture in the Pacific. Overall debt coming from donors has continued to grow over this period. In 2011, lending made up 7% of all captured financial flows to the Pacific. In 2017, that number has jumped to 16%. So while aid has remained relatively flat over this period, it is still becoming less generous as more aid is being shifted towards lending, which, while cheap, still has to be paid back. And to unpack some of these dynamics further, I'm now going to pass over to my colleague, Roland. Thanks, Roland.
Thanks, Jonathan, and good evening, everyone. So for my part of the presentation, what I'm going to be talking about is this very lovely question of, is China engaged in so-called debt trap diplomacy in the Pacific? And in particular, this will be based on a forthcoming paper that we've been working on, which should be out in the next week or so, where we basically try to leverage the data in the Pacific aid map, combine it with some other data and analysis to look at debt sustainability in the Pacific, and in particular, the role of both Chinese lending, but also Australia's own new infrastructure lending plans as well. But for tonight, I'm just going to focus on this question of debt trap diplomacy. And in particular, does the evidence suggest that China is purposely seeking to push countries into debt problems in order to be able to extract geopolitical concessions? Now, obviously, this is a very difficult question to answer because it largely comes down to a question of motive. And that's a very difficult thing to prove or disprove. However, if it was true, then there are certain things you might expect to also be true if this was happening. For one, you might expect China to already be causing high and worsening debt sustainability risks across the Pacific. Two, you might expect China to be the dominant creditor or source of new loans in the Pacific and therefore have considerable leverage over Pacific nations. Third, you might expect Chinese loans to be much more expensive than other official creditors and therefore, in a sense, predatory. Or four, you might expect Chinese lending to be heavily skewed towards countries that are already facing elevated debt risks and therefore, in a sense, predatory in nature. And so basically what I'm going to do through this presentation is take us through where we've landed on each of these issues and where we think the evidence is currently pointing. So the first question, is China the main driver behind high and worsening debt risks across the Pacific? So here we basically rely on the debt sustainability analyses which have been done by the International Monetary Fund. And for most countries in the Pacific, the IMF basically produces a traffic light system rating of low, moderate, or high risk of debt distress. For some countries, the higher income ones, Nauru, Palau, and Fiji, the IMF just has a binary rating of sustainable or unsustainable. But the key point from this chart is basically there's a lot of red, and it's getting slightly worse over time. So the IMF ratings point to high and worsening risks across the Pacific. So then the next question is, to what extent has Chinese lending played into this dynamic? And the first thing to note is China is not an active lender in a whole bunch of these countries. It's only an active lender in six countries. The ones here shown, Fiji, PNG, Samoa, Tonga, Vanuatu, and as well as the Cook Islands, which isn't shown because it doesn't have an IMF rating. So what we did was we worked through all of the debt sustainability analyses that have been done by the IMF over this period to see what was the story. So what did we find? Well, predictably, there's a lot of other things going on other than Chinese lending. So there's a fair degree of economic mismanagement, for example, particularly in Papua New Guinea. There's been some very big natural disasters, in particular in Vanuatu, Tonga, and Samoa. And there's also been some very important changes to the IMF's methodology for calculating these ratings as well, which to an extent exaggerate the degree of deterioration that's occurred over this period. So for example, if we look at Tonga and Samoa in 2016 to 2017, those two countries moved from moderate risk to high risk of debt distress according to the IMF ratings. But if you read the reports, the IMF makes it pretty clear that this is due to a change in methodology rather than a change in the actual underlying economic situation. So is China the main driver behind high and worsening debt risk across the Pacific? You'd have to say, you know, not really. It's one of many factors that have been at play in the region. What about this question? Has China become a dominant creditor in the Pacific? This one's pretty easy to answer quickly. So here we show the share of public debt held by different creditors for the six countries where China has been a creditor. And so the China is, of course, in the red. And what you can see there is two fairly simple points. One, China is only dominant in Tonga, where it accounts for more than half of Tonga's debt. But elsewhere in the region, it's the traditional donors, the ADB, the World Bank, and Japan, all domestic creditors, particularly in PNG and PNG, which hold the majority of debt. So China hasn't become the dominant creditor in the Pacific, with the exception, important exception, of Tonga. Related question, you know, that's kind of backward looking at the existing stock of debt. But what about new debt that's coming onto the books? So what we did here is we used the data in the Pacific Aid Map to look at the flow of new loans coming into the Pacific and who's been providing them. So here's the breakdown. So as you can see, China is pretty big. It's a little over a third of all lending going into the region over 2011 to 2017. However, the ADB is still bigger, a little over 40%, right, over the same period. And more importantly, if we add up the traditional donors, ADB, World Bank, and Japan, these still provide over 60% of all new loans flowing into the region. And why is it important to think of it in that way? Well, the reason is because it means that the Pacific still has plenty of options which follow existing global standards, right? That's why this is important. Global standards in terms of debt sustainability rules, in terms of environmental and social safeguards, and in terms of cost-benefit analysis, so on and so forth. Therefore, traditional donors still play the main role, even in terms of loans, and as Jonathan pointed out earlier, definitely in terms of grants. Are Chinese loans too expensive? Well, from global studies, we know that most of China's official overseas lending has been basically commercial in nature, and only a small proportion of this has actually been concessional. So that raises the red flags. However, in the Pacific, we see a very different picture. So according to the data that we have in the Pacific Aid Map, what we find is that the vast majority, 97% of the loan flows that have come from China into the Pacific have come via export-import bank in the form of Exim concessional loans. Right? So a very different picture compared to the rest of the world. Globally, the Exim Bank is still active in a similar way, but you've also got China Development Bank having an equally large presence, plus you've got a lot of activity coming from China's other state-owned commercial banks. But in the Pacific, as far as we were able to tell, most of the loans coming through have been coming through from China Exim Bank, and they call them concessional loans. But of course, China doesn't follow the OECD rules when it comes to determining what counts as aid and what's concessional or not concessional. So this leaves us with the question, are these loans actually concessional the way we would understand that, right? And so when I say concessionality, I'm talking about the interest rate being charged, I'm talking about the length of maturity, longer is better, and I'm talking about the grace period. So that's the period during which they don't have to make any repayments. And of course, longer is better again. And so what we did was basically the OECD has a standardized way to try and measure how concessional a loan is. I won't take you through all of how that is done, but we basically applied that to the standard Chinese Exim loan to see how do they come up. And that's the basic result. So the OECD requires a minimum 25% rate of concessionality on the loan. And as you can see, standard China Exim loan has a rate of about 55%. So it's concessional by the OECD standard. And therefore, what does that mean? It's concessional enough technically to count as official development assistance according to the OECD rules. A second question we might ask on the same front is, China more expensive than other major creditors in the Pacific? So basically, we just repeated the same exercise for the other major creditors and their main lending instruments in the Pacific. And so those are the results. And basically what you can see is that China is sort of middle of the pack, right? It's less concessional than Japan and ADB and World Bank concessional lending windows, but it's a little bit more concessional than some of the other instruments that the ADB and World Bank use, particularly for higher income countries in the Pacific. That's particularly Fiji and to some extent PNG. But overall, Chinese loans actually have been concessional into the Pacific as far as we can tell. And you know, don't compare too badly compared to other official lenders in the region. Is Chinese lending skewed towards countries already facing elevated debt risks? So to me, this is probably the most important question when we're talking about debt trap diplomacy, right? So you might consider it to be debt trap diplomacy. What China was doing was basically showing up in countries where the IMF has already been there and said this country is at a high risk of debt distress, and then doling out really big loans, right? So in order to systematically analyze this situation, what we did was we went through all the loan projects in the Pacific Aid map and matched that with the IMF rating at the time that each loan agreement was signed. And we did that for all of the donors in the aid map to examine the pattern of Chinese lending in the Pacific compared to these other major lenders. So here are the results. So first, just to get us going, let's look at the ADB. You can see in nearly 45% of ADB lending went to countries at the time had a moderate risk of debt distress, according to the IMF. 35% went to low risk and a little bit to the other categories. Here's the World Bank. Roughly 45% to low risk, maybe 35% to moderate risk, and some going into the sustainable category, which is largely Fiji. Here's Japan. Nothing in sustainable, and so most of it's all in low risk and moderate risk. And here's China. So what does this tell us? Well, first, roughly 90% of China's loans are basically following the same pattern as the other major creditors, right? 45% roughly is going into low-risk environments, and then smaller portions into the other areas. So most of it's following the broad pattern. But, of course, that bit down there is problematic. So about 10% of China's loans have been flowing into countries when at the time there was already an IMF rating of a high risk of debt distress. So right there and there, there is clearly China's lending patterns poses important risks to Pacific debt sustainability if this kind of pattern of lending was to continue. Is that debt trap diplomacy then? Well, not necessarily, and I say that for several reasons. One, as I said before, 90% of China's loans have basically gone to countries or country situations that, where they can basically absorb that debt sustainably, according to the IMF analysis. Second, I haven't shown Taiwan on this chart, and I don't want to pick on Taiwan, but Taiwan is in fact a bigger outlier in terms of this pattern of lending. And 70% of Taiwan's loans during this period went to situations where the country was at a high risk of debt distress. Now, Taiwan's, of course, a far smaller lender into the Pacific than China is. It's 30 times smaller, in fact. But it's still been quite significant when you look at who it's been lending to and how large those loans are relative to the size of those economies. And in particular, for example, Taiwanese loans to Kiribati amounted to about 10% of Kiribati's GDP, and Kiribati was at a high risk of debt distress at the time. The other point to note is that even the ADB has had some difficulties with avoiding potentially problematic loans. So as you can see in the chart, there has been some, very minor, but still some lending to high risk situations. And a bit more important, there's also been some questionable loans prior to IMF ratings being completed for some countries. And that's basically in the gray, where the ADB had made some loans when there was no IMF rating in place, but very shortly afterwards, when the IMF did finally do a rating for those countries, it rated those countries to be at a high risk of debt distress. So the point here is simply that it's very hard to prevent risky loans without a strong institutional setup to avoid it, and China clearly doesn't have that. So what are our overall conclusions? Well, the overall evidence suggests Chinese lending does pose clear risks, but it's not necessarily debt trap diplomacy, at least so far. Rather, the problems appear to reflect the sheer scale of Chinese lending and the lack of strong institutional mechanisms to avoid potentially unsustainable loans. Limited remaining debt space in many Pacific countries means continued lending at the same scale that China has in the past would inevitably very quickly lead to substantial risks of creating future debt problems. So China can't keep doing what it's been doing without eventually causing debt sustainability problems in the region. More positively, China does appear to be taking debt sustainability much more seriously. There's been comments directly from Xi Jinping, but also commitments made at the G20 on debt sustainability, as well as China releasing its own debt sustainability analysis tool to guide its lending under the Belt and Road Initiative. But this will need to be properly operationalized through formal lending rules, which is something they haven't yet done, if China truly wants to avoid fulfilling the debt trap accusations of its critics. So thank you. That's this bit of the presentation, and I think we're going to move to panel and question and answers.
All right. Well, thank you all for a very interesting presentation. As Jonathan mentioned, I'm Natasha Kassam. I'm a research fellow here, and I was previously posted to Beijing and to Honiara. And in fact, I've just come back from a month in Taiwan, so I'm feeling very conflicted about the news this week. Many things going on there. But we'll start with Jonathan. Something I've heard said quite a lot recently is that the Pacific has been neglected by Australia. And suddenly, for someone like me, who was posted to the regional assistance mission to Solomon Islands, that Australia spent about $2.6 billion on, didn't feel neglected 10 years ago. So how do you place the current Pacific step up in the context of Australia's relationship with the Pacific?
I think, Tash, you might have even heard that from me, like a lot, that Australia has neglected our region. And you're totally right in one sense that, you know, we have never, the investment from Australia in the Pacific has never been lacking. And Ramsay is an excellent illustration of when Australia really puts its mind to it, it does big things in the Pacific that really make a difference. And so I'm not at all trying to marginalise the Ramsay Initiative. I'm a full supporter. But what has been lacking in the past, I think, is a consistency of attention. So the investment's always been there, but the attention, particularly at the highest levels of government, has been lacking. And that's really been turned around with Scott Morrison. I mean, no one quite understands where this conviction has come from, but he has certainly thrown the Pacific right into the center of his foreign policy agenda, and it doesn't look to be going anywhere. So that, I think, is the major distinction. Like, our data shows that no one comes close to Australia on aid. Australia is the biggest player in all other realms, you know, trade, investment, migration. But it's that attention that I think that the Pacific has been wanting, and they're now really getting it. In fact, they're probably getting a bit too much of it. You know, I think, is there such a thing as too much? Well, we're going to find out.
All right. Well, then, staying on the Solomon Islands for a moment, I think we thought we were going to have to do a bit of a will they or won't they portion for this evening, but now, officially, Solomon Islands has changed its diplomatic recognition. It no longer recognises Taiwan, and it does recognise China. So, Alex, what do you think this means for the rest of the region, and are we going to see other allies of Taiwan follow?
That's a good question. Well, I guess it really depends on where you sit, right? Like, for Taiwan, I guess it's a big diplomatic blow because, well, you know, the Solomon Islands were their actually biggest ally in the Pacific. The population of the Solomon Islands is bigger than the population of all the other Taiwanese ally in the Pacific united. And actually, the Solomon Islands was also the place where Taiwan has the biggest investment in the region. So, yeah, I think it's a big loss, let's say, for Taiwan. It's a big win for China. So that's when you look at Taiwan, right? When you look at the Solomon Islands, is it going to change? Well, for now, we actually don't know because we don't know what's the package. We don't know what they're going to receive. And so we don't know if it's going to be a better situation or not. When you look at Australia, I think that for us, like our diplomat, well.
Australian national over here.
Well, yeah, like for us, the French people, no. So the French Australian, no, but what I mean is that for Australians, I think it doesn't really change the diplomatic relationship, the bilateral relationship that they have with the Solomon Islands, right? Like, so Australia has invested, as Juno said, a lot of time and resources to make the Solomon Islands a stable place. And it doesn't really matter what are the diplomatic relationship of the Solomon Islands to, I mean, they won't impact the relation that Australia has with the Solomon Islands. I think for the US, it's a bit different. Over the last 2 years, we saw that the US was really pushing for the countries of the Pacific to actually support Taiwan. And seeing that there was this diplomatic switch can be, it's a strategically, that's a loss, I think, for the US. And this actually has been, I mean, I read an article this morning that said that the Prime Minister Segovia was supposed to meet with the Vice President Mike Pence on the sideline of the UN General Assembly next week. And apparently Mike Pence just said, no, look, it's not worth us meeting. So, yeah, we were going to see. I think the Pacific Island countries also are looking at the Solomon Islands. They're taking the Solomon Islands as a case in point to see, all right, let's see what's happening when a country switched diplomatic alliance from Taiwan to China.
I think that, one of the questions that has been asked about China, perhaps, and the package it might be giving to Solomon Islands is the level of debt that countries like Solomon Islands can take on. And Roland, you've already said that the narrative of debt trap diplomacy, which I personally think is driving a lot of this kind of increased engagement in the region, is not necessarily the whole story there. But how does the level of indebtedness in the Pacific compare to other countries worldwide in a similar position? And what about countries like Tonga, which you demonstrated that do have a high level of debt to China? How able are they to service this kind of debt?
Yeah, well, I think, as we know, and that's why we need things like the Pacific Aid Map, China's overseas lending is incredibly opaque. They don't put out much official lending. So, for example, they've recently been reporting to the Bank for International Settlements their overseas lending flows, but they don't show the Bank of International Settlements what the flows are to particular countries. They only get an aggregate. And so that was only a very recent development. So that just shows how far behind China is in terms of transparency around its overseas lending flows. There was, in fact, one pretty, you know, painstaking academic study that was recently released where they tried to get an overall picture of what's going on in terms of China's overseas lending. They including drawing upon the Pacific Aid Map, but also combining it with a whole bunch of other data sources for the entire globe. And one of the key findings from that was they found that as much as 50% of China's overseas lending might be what they termed hidden, in the sense that it doesn't actually show up in international debt statistics or in private credit rating agencies' databases. So there's clearly a very big problem when it comes to understanding China's overseas lending. Having said that, by our research, looking at what we think are the estimates for China's the debt to China within the Pacific, and then comparing that to estimates for other countries around the world, in which there's basically two data sets that one could use, it's pretty clear that the Pacific is among those most heavily indebted to China anywhere in the world. So whatever data source you want to use and compare it to, Tonga, Vanuatu, and Samoa are going to be in the top 10 in terms of indebtedness to China. So the Pacific is very much a big part of the global story around debt sustainability and the Belt and Road Initiative and China's overseas lending patterns. Just quickly on Tonga, I mean, Tonga is the one that's most indebted. Its debt to China is about 25% of GDP. It's at a high risk of debt distress according to the IMF. But it's important to note, when the IMF says a country is at a high risk of debt distress, there's one level that's worse than that, and that's to actually be in debt distress or in an unsustainable debt position. And they're not saying Tonga's in that position just yet. So in that sense, Tonga can repay those loans. Of course, it's never about the economics, it's always about the politics, right, of whether or not they actually want to and to go through the pain that would be involved in having to repay those loans. And the interesting thing there for Tonga, not to go on too long, is that, you know, late last year they basically succeeded in getting some restructuring from China to basically defer the payments that they need to make. And that's kind of good in a sense, because it makes the overall loan more concessional and therefore, theoretically, easier to repay. But 5 years from now, the amount of repayments they're going to have to make are going to be twice as big. And they're going to have to actually repay all 25% of GDP in loans in a very small window of, say, 5 to 7 years. Because basically what they were able to do with the restructuring was defer the payments but not extend the maturity. Right? So there's going to be a lot more pain to come for Tonga 5 years from now, and all they've done is kick the can down the road. So whether they can repay it or not depends on politics, as always.
This also raises another interesting feature we've found in our data, is that there's been a lot of Chinese loans going into the region, but there's been no repayments yet back. So that's something we really want to keep an eye on. These windows now will come due, and they're now starting to have to pay back loans. Tonga was first off the ranks, but Samoa is going to be soon, Vanuatu, PNG. How many countries are actually going to start paying back this debt? It's going to be a really interesting thing to track.
That is incredibly interesting, and particularly for these countries that perhaps are used to the form of aid that they receive from Australia, which is grant and not loan. And so this is possibly a kind of new experience for them in terms of actually paying back some of this money. So
at the same time, I can get away with it. So, you know, why not give it a try as well?
Well, and it's important to not underestimate the agency of some of these governments in
Absolutely.
This that have been able to stand up and renegotiate loans with China. Tonga refused to support China's language on the South China Sea last year. So, you know, as much as we're interested in this, I think we also have to recognize the roles that they're playing for themselves. Now, we have some time for a few questions. I might ask one more at the end, but if you could put up your hand, one of my colleagues will come to you with a microphone. We might just go here on the aisle.
Hi, I'm Jane Anderson. Thanks for a really interesting presentation. Thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm wondering, in some parts of that region, there are some very big corporate players who, either through contract or local obligations, contribute into what we might call development funding. Has that been taken into account by the work you've done? And are you seeing any trends, given that Australia has certainly taken a stronger and stronger position of engaging with privates?
Well, it's something we are trying to look at. The Pacific Aid Map tool, we can incorporate that information in the future, and it's actually something we're planning on doing. But tracking private flows or philanthropic flows or flows that are part of corporate social responsibility plans or deals for mining, mining concessions, that stuff's really hard to track, and there's no centralized data source to pull it all from. So it's going to take a lot of work, but there is a lot of it out there. So it's definitely part of the story that we want to capture. And it's not just private sector; it's also NGOs. NGOs are a major implementing partner for aid agencies in the Pacific, but they also use a lot of charitable contributions to support their efforts in the Pacific. We want to capture that too. We're trying to capture everything that's coming in from the outside. But aid was the starting point, and this almost killed us to put the aid all together. But, give us a few more years and we will capture that. In terms of, are we seeing an uptick in the private sector in the Pacific? Well, actually, where Australia can control, so the private sector as implementing partners. So, you have these Cardno's, ABT, these big companies that implement aid projects. Well, that's actually been pretty steady despite the rhetoric. It's not really increased markedly as a proportion of Australian aid, but it still is a significant component. I think something like 20% of Australian aid is implemented through private sector partners, but that was the case in 2006, it's the case now. Now, in terms of encouraging the private sector to get back into the Pacific, well, unfortunately, we're actually seeing the opposite. Private sector is retreating from the Pacific, Australian private sector at least. Frankly, they just don't see opportunity. Small markets, the tricky regulation, law and order in some countries, they just don't see the opportunity. Now, the Australian government is trying very hard to motivate Australian business to get back involved because to align with our national interest. But unfortunately, we don't have as many levers to pull as the Chinese state might to get the private sector back involved.
Hi, I'm Belinda Lucas. I work as an advisor to DFAT in the Pacific on their Pacific program and their Fiji program, and also work on some other programs in the Pacific too. Your Pacific Aid Map is an extraordinary tool, so congratulations. I just think it's a really powerful tool that can be used in so many ways to make investment decisions and analysis. So thank you. My question, I've got lots, but one is some of your analysis shows, I think, Australia's spending against different sectors, and it shows the Australian investments in governance is really high compared to, say, China, whose investments in infrastructure has been really high historically. With Australia's renewed or new interest in investing pretty deeply and significantly in infrastructure, I'm actually just interested in your analysis of whether you think that plays towards our interest in development effectiveness or our interest in influence in the Pacific, because they are some of the big decisions I think that Australia is making currently in developing its aid investment plans.
You want me to give it a go? All right, should Australia be getting more into infrastructure? I think, the interesting thing is that, of course, Australia's got to have its sort of, it's got to be involved in everything, right? Because we're the biggest donor and we've got the most invested in the region. I think the way in which we're trying to get more in infrastructure now is through things like the AI FFP. I think within reason, that's a reasonably intelligent way to do things. I mean, the big three quarters of the AI FFP is going to be loans and only a quarter of it's going to be grants.
For anyone who doesn't know, it's the Australia Infrastructure Financing Facility for the Pacific, which is a lending facility that we've now established through the step up.
Yeah. Given basically we're in a situation where the overall aid budget is stagnant, if you want to do more in the Pacific, then switching to loans, I suppose, is a reasonable way to do that, because basically you can leverage the amount of grants you've got blended with some loans to create a concessional loan. And that's basically the approach that's being done. And the advantage of doing that then is that you can avoid some of the more difficult trade-offs, right? Having to cut back on governance or health or education, or having to cut back on, say, aid into other parts of the world. So I think that's a reasonable way to go about doing that. But at the end of the day, of course, Australia's got the biggest interests in the Pacific, so it's not like we can step away from things like governance, for example. And infrastructure is, you know, already a field where not only is China doing that, Japan's doing a lot of infrastructure, the ADB is also very big in infrastructure. So it's not clear that infrastructure is necessarily where Australia's comparative advantage is necessarily going to lie. Using loans is also a new thing for DFAT. So basically, DFAT is now going to have to set up and is setting up a whole new system around the AIFFP in order to do this. I think the ambition, though, is pretty good, right? I mean, the reality is that, you know, the ADB and World Bank have been doing this kind of thing for a long time. They have these so-called high standards, but they've also been very slow. And that's created the opportunity for China to step in with maybe, you know, fewer standards, but much greater speed and responsiveness. Now, what the AIFFP is going to be trying to do is to basically match the high standards of the multilateral development banks, but couple that with much faster speed and responsiveness. I reckon that's going to be a pretty hard thing to do, particularly when you don't even have, you're just establishing these new capabilities within your organization. But it's certainly it's the right agenda to actually be trying to do that, because you don't want to let go of the high standards, but you do see a need to try and do something about speed and responsiveness. So, you know, I think the AIFFP has some merits.
But also more broadly, I'm a big fan of the step up, very selfishly speaking. But the step up is all about just doing more. You know, it's not, there's in the Pacific, there is no sacrifice to what Australia is doing. It's just more. But more is coming from a broader context of stagnation. So the aid program is at the lowest levels in Australian history when it comes to generosity as a proportion of our national income, or when it comes to proportion of government expenditure. And so when you say more in the Pacific, that means less somewhere else. We also have a diplomatic deficit where we haven't increased the funding to DFAT for more than 10 years. So somewhere else, well, that's coming from a lot of other places, Southeast Asia, West Asia, Central Asia. You know, all other programs are being cut to the expense of the Pacific. So selfishly, I love that we are doing so much in the Pacific. But as you know, I think we have very important interests elsewhere in the world. That the aid program is a very important tool to prosecute those interests. And it's really disappointing to see the government do the step up at the cost by stepping down elsewhere in the world.
If I can add one comment to that as well, there's only so far we'll be able to get by using this loan approach as well, right? I mean, that without eventually causing problems. Now, the amount of lending that Australia is currently targeting sounds big. We've got, it's $2 billion for the AIFFP. 1.5 billion of it is loans, but actually, relative to the size of the regional economy, it's about 3.6% of regional GDP, and it's probably going to be spent over something like 10 years. So it's really not very big. I'm not so concerned about the AIFFP causing debt sustainability problems, but the fact is, then if you want to do more at some point, you're going to start bumping up against these challenges. So it's not, you can't get away from the fact that we have a stagnant aid budget forever.
Thank you. That's a remarkable tool that you've made. My question is, over the first year that it's been in operation, what feedback have you had as to how it's been used from within the Pacific countries themselves? And like, there's a side question, how usable is it in those countries from an access point of view? Sorry, James Cox from Pacifica, sorry.
Well, yeah, thank you, James Cox from Pacifica, for this question. the feedback that we had actually was pretty good. The governments around the Pacific are actually using it. Also Australia does use it quite a lot, DFAT. We did a roadshow in the United States and had presented the map to the State Department, Department of Interior, Treasury, and everybody was actually very happy to see this tool, because it's for one of the first time it allows people to see who's doing what in the region. When we talk to the Pacific Island countries, this is a bit more mitigated, because as you can see, this is a pretty big tool and pretty powerful. The thing is that you need a pretty strong connection as well to run it.
But a 3G connection is all you need.
3G connection.
So if you just tether it to your phone anywhere in the Pacific, it'll work.
Yeah, and so actually one of the best feedback that we had from the Pacific Pacific countries was, hold on, like, well, this is great. First, we actually didn't have this granularity in our own ministries to be able to trace what you were doing. So can you, well, so thank you very much for doing this. And actually, Papua New Guinea is asking us to do like a kind of training to see that, to teach them how we've done this. And maybe they're going to try to implement this as well.
Our mission over the next 3 years is to spend time in literally every Pacific country doing workshops with the relevant ministries to make sure that they know exactly how much they can get out of this tool. We've done that in a few countries already, but you know, resources are limited, so we have to do it when we're in those countries to begin with. But everywhere we've taken it so far, it's been incredibly well received. The regional agencies, like the Pacific Island Forum, use it to underlie all of their analysis now. The crop agency is the same. So it's definitely getting taken up, but there's much more work to do to make sure that it is getting used by every stakeholder that could use this tool in the region.
Everybody, Jonathan said at the outset that he thought we would start talking about China and promised that we'd finish talking about China. I'm quite pleased that that's not exactly where we've ended up, but perhaps to take us there, my project here at the Lowy Institute is the Lowy Institute poll, which this year found that 74% of Australians think that we should do more to prevent China from increasing its influence in the Pacific. Having said that, only 49% of Australians thought that we should spend more in the Pacific. So there is still a little bit of a disconnect there. If you could join me in thanking our panel, I've learnt so much tonight and I'm sure you all have as well.